This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One day after the Supreme Court's abortion decision, activists on both sides are unhappy and planning their strategies. The court reaffirmed Roe v. Wade, the decision that legalized abortion in 1973. But the court also upheld several provisions of the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, which places certain restrictions on a woman's right to abortion. Now attention has shifted to Congress, where a Freedom of Choice Act protecting abortion rights is expected to pass sometime before the Republican convention. The president has said he would veto such a bill. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Catherine Culbert, the lawyer who argued the case before the Supreme Court challenging Pennsylvania's restrictive abortion law. First, David Wagner joins us. He's the editorial director of the Family Research Council, a pro-family policy and lobbying organization. The group opposes abortion. I asked Wagner how his group viewed the Supreme Court decision.
The result is, on the one hand, Roe is reaffirmed. That, for us, in our view, was a loss. But on the other hand, the permissible range of state regulation, which grew vastly in Webster, has grown yet again. And that's a victory. So, the amazing thing about the reaction, and I've been watching this for more than 24 hours now, is that both sides are enraged, and both sides are right.
This new decision adds what's being described as the undue burden test. And, an undue burden is an obstacle placed in a woman's way that would make it unnecessarily difficult for her to get her, constitutionally justified abortion. What's your opinion of this undue burden test?
Well, I think it's meaningless. When they go to define it, they say, well, an undue burden is a substantial obstacle. Now, undue and substantial are very similar in representing fundamentally policy judgments. Neither of them are legal terms that tell you anything legally. They are you're trapped in a judicial vicious circle when the test that you have, undue burden or anything else, can only be defined with terms that are equally ambiguous. It doesn't really tell us anything to know that an undue burden is a substantial obstacle. Because, well, what's a substantial obstacle? Well, I guess it's an undue burden. I mean, what's going to happen here is that as long as this test is dominant, and it is clearly dominant now, I mean, as a matter of deference to higher judicial authority, lower federal judges are going to have to use the undue burden test for the foreseeable future. And what I think it's going to show is that courts are going to basically apply their own policy judgments. They're going to be you remember the committees that hospitals used to have back before Roe, who would decide whether abortion, hospital review committees, whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, federal judges are going to have to function in that capacity and make that kind of seat of the pants moral judgment, and subject ultimately to correction by the Supreme Court, which will, to the extent that it uses the undue burden test, will just be making seat of the pants judgments of its own.
I think what the justices were saying in terms of undue burden is that it's okay for a state to set up legislation that tries to educate a woman about the hazards of abortion or even try to persuade her against having it, but it's not okay to set up something that would make it very difficult for her to get it, to just put obstacles in her way. And I think that the Right to Life movement has been pretty upfront in making it clear that some of the limitations they want on abortion is basically to figure out ways to prevent women from getting it. So do you think on some theoretical level, the tactics of the Right to Life movement goes against the undue burden test?
Well, you've accurately summarized what the court is trying to do. I mean, what the plurality is trying to do. That's exactly the distinction they're trying to make. And again, you're right that that's the goal of the Right to Life movement is to reduce the number of abortions. And across a very wide range, any given legislative proposal can be conceptualized either as a hindrance or as an effort to deter it. If the constitutional fault line now runs in between deterrence, which is okay, and hindrance, which is not, I think that there's going to turn out to be no principled way to distinguish the two, and no way that legislatures or lower federal courts will be able to predict which goes on which side. Take, for instance, one that they upheld, a 24-hour waiting period. Depending on individual circumstances, that can be a very heavy burden. And yet, that's not it. That the court doesn't hold that an undue burden.
Gary Bauer, who's the president of your group, the Family Research Council, said that he's concerned about the emergence on the court of a wimp block.
Wimp block, yeah.
Yeah, who are quickly becoming an embarrassment to the presidents who appointed them. Do you agree with that? Do you think there's a wimp block on the Supreme Court now?
I think it is. I think it now the most of the media will, I confidently predict, will not adopt as their own the term wimp block. They will call it the mainstream or responsible center plurality. I think this consists of individuals who, consciously or not, see the media as their main constituency and are writing opinions which are apt to earn them praise there, and which have in fact earned them praise already.
Now, Justice Blackmun commended the three justices who wrote the opinion for an act of personal courage and constitutional principle.
That's the sort of ego-stroking that they crave, and Blackmun gives it to them.
So you don't see their decision as an act of personal courage?
Right, it's not in the slightest. It's cowardly. Complete intellectual cowardice.
Are you calling the justices cowards because they disagree with you?
No, I think they're cowards because they knew that they would take major media hits if they had joined in an opinion that reversed Roe v. Wade. There are lots of opinions that I disagree with, which I think do demand courage. And I think, you know, goodness knows I have my bones to pick with Justice Blackmun, but I think that in his way, he's fairly courageous. I mean, he has his stance, and he makes no bones about what he thinks, and I think he's terribly wrong, but I think he has the courage of his convictions. Whereas in the plurality, in the group that Gary calls the wimp block, you see on the one hand, some real disagreement with Roe, some real problems with Roe, and yet a conviction that somehow, even though a majority of the court has some degree of severe problems with Roe, nonetheless, the image of the court, or legitimacy, to use the term they use, I think what they're really talking about is image, requires that they uphold it. And in order to reach this conclusion, they're willing to engage in some rather frank, in my opinion, much too frank discussion in the opinions about the court's legitimacy or lack thereof and their concerns on that point.
The president seems to be in a kind of difficult spot now. The Freedom of Choice Act may be passed in Congress right before the Republican convention in August. And the president has said he would veto such legislation if it was passed. But even in the Republican camp, there's a growing number of people who are pro-choice, and it could actually damage him politically if he vetoes the legislation. So what is your group and your movement going to do to step up pressure on the president?
Well, in a sense, what we've been doing, I mean, it's necessary that the pro-life movement within the Republican Party, which is largely due the political rejuvenation of the Republican Party beginning in the late 1970s, that it's necessary that group show that it's still there. And it has been, largely through the efforts of the Republican National Coalition for Life. But the Family Research Council is nonpartisan, so we've been trying to make our point to the Democrats as well. There's a growing group of pro-life Democrats, which Governor Casey's example is beginning to bring to life. It's less far along in its development than the pro-abortion Republican movement, but the rank-and-file pro-life voters have always been ex-Democrats, and some of them consider themselves to be still Democrats. So I think that the abortion issue, the way the abortion issue ties in with party politics, is going to get more confusing and more interesting as not only pro-abortion Republicans but also pro-life Democrats begin to show their faces publicly. I do think, as a matter of electoral politics, this year, when President Bush, who has taken a pro-life stand and stuck to it, when he's running against two opponents, both of whom are pro-choice, I think continuing to be pro-life clearly cuts in his favor as far as presidential politics this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for your time.
Sure. Well, thank you very much.
David Wagner is the editorial director of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. Shortly before she went to the Supreme Court, Catherine Colbert told us she didn't expect to win. Colbert is the lawyer who argued against the restrictive Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act. She's also co-counsel in challenges to bans on abortion in Louisiana and Guam. Colbert is vice president of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy. We wanted to know if she interprets the Supreme Court's decision as a victory, a defeat, or something in between.
First of all, it's a defeat in that women possessed a fundamental constitutional right to choose abortion the day before yesterday, and yesterday that right is no longer fundamental. That has significant impact, particularly for the women of Pennsylvania, but for many other women in many other states who now must face restrictions that are passed by state legislators and who essentially have been thrown back to the wolves to let the legislatures do as they may and enact laws which interfere with their ability to obtain abortions.
You say that the right to abortion is no longer fundamental, but the plurality opinion upheld Roe v. Wade.
Well, it upheld a different version of Roe versus Wade. Let me explain. Roe did two things. The first thing it did is it said that states such as Texas could not criminalize abortion. That's the part of Roe that the Supreme Court upheld yesterday. But Roe did one other thing, and it said that the right to choose abortion is a fundamental right, that states were not free to put roadblocks in, or hurdles in the path of women on the way to the abortion clinic. They were not able to restrict women's ability to make these personal and private decisions. And Roe established strict scrutiny as the appropriate standard. Now, that's a lawyer's way of saying that every time a state passes a law, it's got to bear the burden of showing that there's some health purpose to it, that it's not just intended to discourage abortion, but it's intended to protect the woman's health. And the Supreme Court took away that part of Roe yesterday by permitting the state of Pennsylvania to place roadblocks in the woman's path. I don't think the court went as far as they could have gone. Nevertheless, I think it is a loss for women, and as Justice Blackmun recognized in his dissenting opinion, the court is only one justice away from overruling Roe altogether.
But isn't the intention of the undue burden test to make sure that something is for valid reasons and not just to be a roadblock in a woman's way?
Well, no, and that's the problem, because the court backed away from health as the operative standard. The court said that a state was free to discourage abortion, was free to use its strength and propaganda to influence the woman's decision away from abortion and toward childbirth. And that permits states in, like Pennsylvania, to enact a bunch of laws which require doctors or put words in the doctor's mouth, which is intended to prevent the procedure, and to enact roadblocks like the waiting periods, which force women to travel many hundreds of miles on two and three occasions in order to obtain the procedure.
Justice Blackmun commended Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter for an act of personal courage and constitutional principle. Do you share that feeling?
Well, I do think that whenever a justice changes a viewpoint, particularly in an area which is so murky, that is so fraught with the politics of this question, that it is a courageous step. I think Justice Blackmun reflected the same surprise that I feel, that the court had shifted. I think he was correct in commending them for taking a step that most people had thought they would not do. Nevertheless, I do believe that the new standard is a tough one, and many women will suffer tremendously as a result of giving states the green light to place roadblocks in women's path. The most significant part of it is that anti-abortion legislators don't stop at little roadblocks. They put many in the path. They want to heap one upon another because their real intent is not to protect women's health at all, but to make abortion so difficult to obtain that the numbers of abortions performed will decrease.
Was there anything in particular that you said in your argument before the Supreme Court that you thought was echoed in the decision?
Well, there were a number of portions of our briefs that were echoed in all of the decisions. In particular, we had made very strong arguments about stare decisis and made two big points about that. Stare decisis is a legal principle that says that courts ought to reaffirm precedent that they, if they've decided one way and it has proved to be a workable decision, it ought to remain, even if a court believes that they would have decided differently in the first instance. The court relied on those arguments, and I think they particularly noted the reliance interest that we had stressed in our briefs, that is, the fact that millions of American women have relied upon the court's preservation of their liberty, and that was a reasonable reliance, and therefore, even if a particular members of the court disagree with the decision, their individual opinion should not be the determinative. Rather, the rulings, prior rulings of the court ought to control.
My guest is Catherine Colbert, the lawyer who challenged Pennsylvania's restrictive abortion law in the Supreme Court. The Congress is expected to vote this summer on the Freedom of Choice Act. And I wonder what role you and your group will be playing in supporting that bill.
Well, Terry, in fact, today I was, before talking with you, was downstairs in the House Judiciary Committee that was hearing the markup on the Freedom of Choice Act, and that bill will move through Congress very quickly. It is my view that federal legislation that codifies the principles of Roe versus Wade are very, very necessary. But my concerns are that whenever a legislative body enters this arena, that efforts to restrict women's rights will try to be attached to that bill. So we're going to be watching it very closely and try to ensure that the rights of all women, the rights of young women, the rights of low-income women, the rights of women who are the most vulnerable in our society will be protected, as well as the rights of adult middle-class women.
The Freedom of Choice Act, as it's written now, I believe, allows states to require the involvement of parents, guardians, or other responsible adults in the abortion decisions of minors. Do you consider that a compromise?
I do, and in fact, I oppose that. It is my view that the Congress ought to pass a codification provision and not address the rights of minors directly. It's my view that when states are given the green light to interfere with young women's decisions, what you end up doing is forcing young women to delay the performance of abortion, forcing young women to endanger their health. We've learned from Indiana, when Becky Bell was forced into a back alley abortion, that unfortunately parental notification and consent laws are not as innocuous as they sound. They cost women their lives. That's a very serious matter, and it's my preference that those not be permitted under the current legal standard.
If the Supreme Court did actually overturn Roe, is there anything that Congress could do to ensure a woman's right to abortion?
Well, they could do what they're doing now. That is, they could pass the Freedom of Choice Act that codifies the principles of the earlier Supreme Court decision, or they could pass a constitutional amendment that would then go out to the states for ratification. I prefer the statutory route because it's a lot faster. It can be done on a majority vote. But as long as you have a president who's going to veto the bill, you need two-thirds of Congress to override that veto.
But the thing is, if the Supreme Court takes precedence in its constitutional interpretation, wouldn't that take precedence over any congressional legislation guaranteeing a woman's right to abortion?
If the Supreme Court overruled Roe, it would essentially be saying there's no right to privacy. Nevertheless, Congress could create a statutory right protecting women's abortion decisions. The only time they couldn't do that would be if the Supreme Court went so far as to find a constitutional right for the fetus. Even this court's unlikely to do that. So I think that we are clearly on safe legal ground in having Congress act and act expeditiously.
The last time you were on Fresh Air, I asked you about the case on abortion you argued before the Supreme Court in 1985, and asked you about what surprised you most when you were arguing the case, and you said that one of the things that really surprised you with it, there were no women's lavatories for lawyers arguing cases in the Supreme Court. And you were hoping that that would be changed by now. So was it?
No, unfortunately it was not. They actually went so far as to redo the lawyer's waiting room. It's a beautiful new facility, but the women's bathroom is still down the hall. It's unfortunate, but true.
Catherine, what are some of your most vivid memories from this time around from challenging the Pennsylvania abortion law in the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, Terry, the most significant part of the argument was that the court was extremely quiet. The first 7 minutes, not a single justice asked a question. And I'd been prepared for that eventuality, but I think that there was this incredible surprise among all of the people sitting in the room, and that was quite a stirring moment when the first justice asked a question, because I think everybody was kind of shocked that someone had decided to challenge me. That was Justice O'Connor, and she really did want me to articulate agreement with her undue burden standard. I was unwilling to do that. But I think that our discussion about that standard certainly helped to shape the court's view today.
What was that discussion like?
Well, she wanted me to address the specifics of the Pennsylvania law, and what I did instead is to talk about Roe and the importance of Roe and the importance of stare decisis, and that seemed to be a discussion that influenced the court to adopt that doctrine.
Mm-hmm. In the plurality decision, it was written that the ability of women to participate equally in the economy and social life of the nation has been facilitated by their ability to control their reproductive lives. Were you surprised to read that?
Well, actually, it was very interesting to me. We had, in our briefs, made three arguments about the underpinnings of Roe, the importance of bodily integrity, the importance of personal autonomy, that is, the ability to make personal and private decisions, and lastly, the ability of women to function as equals in society. And I was very gratified that the court recognized that. Justice Blackmun had recognized that back in the Thornburg decision. I think this was a clearer and stronger explication of that viewpoint, and I was very pleased to see it. Because, let me just say, I think that the reason the abortion issue has become such a focal point of the political debate in this country is precisely because it seems to define gender equality for many Americans. Women understand that if they can't control their reproductive decision-making, they can't control other decisions in their lives. If you are forced to have children, you are forced to give up other things that you may want to do, and it will intimately affect your self-determination. So when women fight for the right to choose abortion, they're fighting for equality, and they understand that when we take steps backward, they are losing rights to equality, and I think that's in some ways why we have such vehement opposition.
Lawyer Catherine Colbert, she argued in the Supreme Court against the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act. Colbert is the vice president of the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.